This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Teachers have a huge effect on the lives of their students, and one of the biggest and most important part of a teacher's job is something where they get little to no training or guidance: handing out grades.
Grading is one of the most important things that teachers do, and it brings their entire professional discretion and judgment to students, and they detest it.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a veteran educator who says the way teachers grade their students in the U.S. is broken and how that system can be fixed. Then we'll wait until the very end of the show for an academic minute on procrastination. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Getting good grades is one of the goals every student starts the year with. But for teachers, when it comes to giving good grades, they're kind of on their own. And in the end, many good students are given bad grades that have very little to do with what they've actually learned. That's the topic of Joe Feldman's new book. It's called Grading for Equity: What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. Joe Feldman is an educator who worked as a teacher, principal, and district superintendent. He served as director of charter school development in New York City. He's now the CEO of Crescendo Education in Oakland, California. I asked him why he took on the topic of grades and why they're so important.
Well, we know that when we think about school, we can't help but think about grades, and some of the most important decisions that we make about students are based on the grades that they get. And these decisions can affect the trajectory of their lives. So it's not just, am I going to be promoted to the next grade, or am I eligible to play on the athletic field, which are all determined based on grades, but it has to do with, will I get to graduate? What college will I go to? Will I get scholarships? Even in many states, the insurance rates that students get are based on the grades they get. We know that in addition to that, grades have a big psychological impact on how kids think about themselves and their capacity for success. The problem is that teachers get virtually no training or support in how to grade. And so, unfortunately, the traditional way that teachers grade are mathematically unsound, they're highly subjective and biased, and they often demotivate students. So what they do is these practices actually perpetuate the achievement and opportunity gaps in our schools. And after 20 years as a teacher and principal and district administrator, I felt like I knew enough and had enough reasons and enough problems I was seeing that I felt like this needed to be taken on.
Well, the name of the book is Grading for Equity. Where does equity come into this?
Well, it's in a couple of places. First of all, there are a number of structural inequities that are in our traditional grading system. So one example is that if I had two students in a classroom and they're both learning how to write a persuasive essay, one student, the summer before we started the year, they went to a summer camp at the local college and learned about writing and learned how to write a great persuasive essay. So they come in on the first day of school, and the unit begins, and they write a dynamite persuasive essay, and they get an A on it. And through the whole term of working on the persuasive essay skills, they keep getting A's. And so at the end of the term, they get an A. There's another student sitting next to them who maybe was in North Carolina for the summer or had to work, or parents couldn't afford to put them in that kind of a summer program. And so they come in the first day. They have no idea how to write a persuasive essay, and so they get an F at the beginning. But over the term, they get better and better and better, and by the end, they get an A. So in our traditional grading system, the first student gets an A, and the second student, their performance is averaged over time. So they had F at the beginning, and then they slowly got better, so their average is somewhere around a C. So even though by the end of that unit, the students actually have the same quality essay writing skills, the second student is penalized because we're averaging their performance over time, and we're creating inaccuracies because we're actually misrepresenting what that student knows, and we're penalizing them for things outside of their control and that actually end up reinforcing and perpetuating the achievement gaps, because the first student who has the resources and the privileges is able to keep getting higher grades than the students who don't. And so that's one of the sort of structural inequities. By averaging a student's performance over time, which is done in almost every grading program out there, it is penalizing students with fewer resources.
You do spend a lot of time in the book talking about grades and mathematical accuracy. And we come to the old motivational F, or the zero. What is wrong with zeros?
Well, there's two problems. The first is that there is no research to support the idea that if a student isn't doing well, if I give them a zero, or if they didn't turn something in and I give them a zero, it's going to motivate them to do better. All the research says that if you give students zeros, it's going to demotivate them. So that's the first problem. And I think teachers feel like, well, I don't know what other choices are available to me. I have no choice but to give them a zero if they don't turn something in. The second problem is a more mathematical one. And I guess the simplest way to describe the problem is that on a traditional 0 to 100 scale, a passing grade is a D, which is at 60. So a 0 to 59 is an F. So if you think about it, almost two-thirds of our grading scale is based on failure, and about a third of it is based on success, which seems absurd on its face. And when you give students zeros, they're so much farther that they have to go up to get from a zero to a D. They have to go up 59 points to then finally get a passing score. Whereas if I want to go from a D to a C, I just have to go from a 60 to a 70, which is only a 10-point difference. So we've actually got a 0 to 100 scale that is disproportionately oriented toward failure and makes it very, very difficult for students who start getting some zeros to salvage themselves and get out of that. So by giving zeros, you really are destroying the possibility of a student getting a better grade, and students know that. Teachers talk about how midway through the term, if students have a bunch of zeros, they know that it's mathematically impossible for them to pass. And it's really because we're using a faulty grading scale.
What kind of biases do teachers bring in when grading?
So this is another aspect of the equity, not just the institutional inequities, but sort of personal implicit biases. Implicit biases is when people are bringing their subjective judgments to make assumptions or perceptions about what they see students doing that may not be correct. So a traditional grading has a category called participation, which is really evaluating students on their behavior. So things like, do I bring a notebook to class? Am I taking notes? Am I not talking when other people are in a discussion? And teachers will give them participation points. Unfortunately, what teachers will do on something like participation is they'll look for student behaviors that match what the teacher did to be successful. So I always took notes in school, so I think if you take notes, you're learning, so I'm going to give you points if you take notes. A problem is that taking notes doesn't necessarily have any relationship to learning for the diversity of students who we have. So there may be students who may just show rapt attention and be taking everything in and learning, even though they're not taking notes and we might be penalizing them. And with implicit biases, often it's applied to race. So if I, as a white teacher, may have rules for a discussion and some of the rules are you can't talk when another student is talking. Only one person can talk at a time. And I'm going to give you points for doing that. But the problem is that is a very white, middle-class idea of how to have a discussion. Whereas in other cultures, African-American in particular, there's actually a value in having people talk over each other and having multiple voices in the same part of the conversation as creating sort of this symphony of voices and ideas. And I would be penalizing students who are African American if they engage in that kind of behavior when they have a discussion, even though they may be just as engaged and learning just as much.
What are the consequences of including homework in a final grade?
So there's a couple problems with homework. One is the structural inequities. So let me first back up. Teachers want to include points for homework completion or accuracy, right? So I assign a piece of reading and some questions, and a student comes back and they get 5 points for doing the homework or completing the questions correctly. Teachers believe that I need to do that in order to motivate students to do the homework, because if I don't give them points, they won't do it. One problem is that we don't ever know actually who's doing the homework, because when a student takes it out of the room, oftentimes a student might get help from a parent or a tutor or a sibling or another student. And so the points that we're awarding that student may not be points that they have earned to show their learning. The second is that homework is much more likely to be completed if a student has support and resources, right? Somebody who they can ask if they have questions, if they have a quiet space and a well-lit space at home, if they have access to the internet. all these resources that higher income kids will have and lower income kids will not. If I have to go home and I have to work or take care of my younger siblings every day, or I don't have a quiet space or it's not well lit, I'm much less likely to do homework. That's one more example of how we are adding in aspects to a grade that will widen the achievement gap rather than reduce it.
All right, so what does equitable grading look like, and do teachers have the time to even think about it?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that when teachers start to learn about these new practices, a lot of light bulbs go off and a lot of realizations like, oh, of course I should be doing it this way. How could I have ever been doing it this traditional way? And I wonder about how much harm I was doing to students inadvertently because I never got any way to learn how I could grade better. So while they have to learn the new practices, once they start using them, it starts opening up a whole new exciting world for them. One example is if I'm no longer tallying every student behavior in a class, including in participation, and I'm not entering every homework assignment every day, I now have half hour, an hour, even more every day and more minutes in every class to actually think about instruction and curriculum and how to support my students individually. Teachers talk about how it frees up a lot of their time to do the things that they want to do as teachers. No teacher likes to enter data into a grade book. They have much better ways of spending their time to help their students learn. So equitable grading is more accurate. So we're using mathematical calculations that better represent what students actually know. We're not including things like homework in the grade. That doesn't mean we're not assigning homework, and it doesn't mean that we're not expecting students to do it, but we're not including that for points in a grade. And we're doing things to motivate them. So if a student doesn't do well at the beginning, but they do well at the end, they can show their learning. Their work will not be average. So this and a number of other practices help grading to be more equitable, to not reward students with privilege and punish those without, and to actually reduce the achievement gap. What we're seeing is when we do this with teachers, they actually have a decrease in D's and F's, and they actually have a decrease in A's, because what we haven't talked about is how often our traditional system inflates grades. The student who does their homework every day continues to get all these points, even though they may never have done it. They have just copied every time. Or the student who is an angel and does everything the teacher asks, it keeps getting higher and higher grades, even though they may not have learned anymore. We've had examples where a student who doesn't know the content very well and maybe is getting C averages in their tests and quizzes and things like that, because they've been so nice and done everything the teacher asked and just all the right behaviors, they're getting B's in the class. They go to the next grade level and they get crushed because they actually haven't had the content understanding to be able to get there. And they have no idea why, because everyone has been telling them, you're fine, you're fine, you're fine, you've been getting B's.
Still to come, we'll see if a student's so-called soft skills should be included in grades when our conversation with educator and author Joe Feldman continues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Joe Feldman, a teacher, principal, and district superintendent, and the former director of charter school development in New York City. He's now the CEO of Crescendo Education in Oakland, California. And we're talking about his new book, Grading for Equity: What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. I asked about a student's so-called soft skills and how they should show up in grades.
Yeah, so soft skills we've talked a lot about in the past couple of decades, but it's been part of our schooling for a long time. It's the idea that we don't just want students who know how to read, write, speak. We want students who can work with each other in groups, and students who can come on time, and students who can do other things that you know, aren't necessarily around the content, but we feel like will help them be successful in the professional world. And what we have done traditionally is reward them with points. It goes back to giving them points for homework or points for participation. We just want to sort of give them some credit in the grade for it. The problem with that is that we are, A, using an extrinsic motivation system. So we believe students will only do things if we give them points, when in fact we know that students are motivated intrinsically. Students will show soft skill proficiency when they understand the value of it for themselves, and they'll actually do it much more consistently and much better when they recognize that. For example, students working in a group, many teachers will give students points for how well they work as a group. The problem with that is that we actually don't care if students work well in a group just because they work well in a group. We believe that if students work well in a group, they will learn more. What we should be doing instead is looking at, did they learn more? How did the students do on the assessments or tests or other projects that we gave them? And if they did well, we look back and say, what did you do as a group that helped you learn? And how can you keep doing those behaviors? And if they didn't show success on that assessment, we go back and say, okay, let's look at what happened in your group. Why didn't that work? What didn't you guys do well that helped you learn? So students start to realize that, oh, I don't just do well in a group because the teacher told me to and I get points for it, but I need to work well in a group because when I start working well in the group, I'm going to learn more. I'm going to be more productive. And that's really what we need to reconnect students to, is the relationship between the soft skills they show and how much they learn.
Does getting good grades actually prepare us for the real world afterwards?
Interestingly, there's been some research that's shown that the standardized test scores on SAT and ACT don't correlate with high performance in college as much as grades do, that the high grades you get have a stronger correlation to strong performance in college. The problem with that, and I'll use this a little flippantly, is saying, well, dirt tastes better than rocks. I mean, yes, grades are more strongly correlated to success in college than tests, than the SAT, but that's because they're both generally and traditionally terrible predictors. What we're seeing instead is that when grades are reflecting what students know and not how well they behave, their performance is actually increasing in college and beyond because they have the skills they need for success in the coursework. They learn the soft skills as a means to an end and then become successful. It also, teachers liken grades to the workplace, and they say, well, you know, if you don't come on time, you could lose your job, and so if you don't come on time in my class, you lose points. But that's actually not what happens in the real world, except for the lowest level professional careers. What more often happens is your boss says to you, oh, you came in late. Maybe they ignore it the first time. Maybe the second time they say, hey, is everything okay? The third time it's, hey, you know, I think we should have a discussion about this. I want to make sure that you know how important it is to come on time. And then the fourth time, and et cetera. So there's so many multiple stages and multiple ways of feedback. And so teachers can think about what are all the ways they can give feedback to students that help them show certain behaviors and learn how to do things the right way. Not everything has to be packed into the grade, because when you do that, it starts warping the accuracy and perpetuating all the inequities that we've talked about.
Do you see a time when school will be grade-free?
I'm sort of agnostic on whether there should be grades at all. I think we're in a world that people want to know how to organize students and make decisions about them. And if you have totally narrative grading, I think it becomes very difficult to get consistency. So I think that having some shorthand way of describing what students know is a good thing. I do think that we could learn a lot from elementary school report cards. In elementary school, there's a listed set of skills that students are asked to show, and then there's an individual grade for each. When they get to middle school, students get a single grade for a course, so only one grade for all the different math skills. And I think instead we could make the middle school and high school report cards much more like an elementary school report card. So in Algebra 1, here are the 8 different skills that students were expected to know and be able to do, and this is how they did on each of them. It would create much more transparency for parents and families, and it would create much more transparency for all the decision makers, including colleges. There's a group of schools right now that have organized what's called the Mastery Transcript Consortium. And this group is figuring out ways to have the transcript that students send to colleges be organized like the elementary school report card, because they know it provides more complete information about their students, and it gives much better information to admissions officers. And a number of colleges are really taking to this method of communication.
Okay, so finally, if I get a group of teachers in a room, five or six teachers, and say, grades, what do you think? Are they going to be quiet or are they going to yell at me?
One of the ironies is that grading is one of the most important things that teachers do, and it brings their entire professional discretion and judgment to students, and they detest it. No teacher likes to grade, and they realize that part of the difficulty is because it's so complex and they've never gotten any support. When I start working with teachers, initially, they're very resistant to think about their grading differently. Grading is one of the few areas that teachers have that has not been mandated by the district. There's no curriculum requirement for grading. They get to decide it for themselves, and so they protect it very tightly. But the good news is when they start to learn about the history of our grading system in this country, it's been here since the Industrial Revolution, when they start to learn how it can harm their students and create inequities, they realize that this is so much better, and they're finally getting the professional support they've wanted, and they gravitate to it. They talk about how much it's totally changed how they teach for the better and built a lot better relationships with students where there's much more trust.
Again, the name of Joe Feldman's new book is Grading for Equity: What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. It's published by Corwin. Getting around to doing something is easier for some people than others. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Everyone procrastinates, but not everyone is a procrastinator. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Joseph Ferrari, professor of psychology at DePaul University, discusses this common phenomenon.
Do you clean your house instead of working on a big project? Do you put off sorting through your closet because it seems daunting? You might be a procrastinator. People throw around that term procrastination frequently, but it's very real and can have very real consequences. Procrastination is a tendency to delay the start or completion of a desired task to the point of experiencing discomfort. It leads to dysfunctional ways of being, a reduced quality of life. Procrastination is not the same as waiting, postponing, or delaying. In my research on procrastination, I have found that everybody procrastinates, but not everyone is a procrastinator. Because while everyone may delay a task, there are as many as 20% of normal adult men and women from around the world who make procrastination their maladaptive lifestyle. Postponing at home, at work, at school, in relationships, this is their way of life. 20% is higher than rates for many other diseases and conditions. Yet, we treat the illness of procrastination as a funny topic, as just laziness, as just poor time management. To battle against procrastination, focus on the future. Don't regret what you didn't accomplish. Do you want to be proud of yourself, or do you want to live in regret? Spend time with doers who get things done. Talk to them. Ask them for their advice. Model their behavior. And realize that you're not alone. You learned this tendency. You can unlearn it. Procrastination is not adaptive. You are actually missing much of life. So leave a legacy. Don't procrastinate. Just do it now.
That was Joseph Ferrari of DePaul University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.